Hey everyone, welcome back to True Crime Cases. I'm your host, Allison Mendes, and today I'm going to be covering the murders of Kenyatta Barron and Rhonavia O'Neill, as well as the incredible survival story of 8-year-old Ronnie Jr. In the early morning hours of March 19th, 2018, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office in Tampa Bay, Florida, responded to a 911 call regarding a domestic violence dispute at the home of 29-year-old Ronnie O'Neill and 33-year-old Kenyatta Barron. When law enforcement arrived on the scene around midnight, they found Kenyatta Barron lying face down on the sidewalk near the home. Shortly after the sheriff's office arrived, the Hillsborough County Fire Rescue arrived as well, and they declared Kenyatta was deceased upon arrival. Initially, the residence had been completely dark when law enforcement arrived on the scene, but shortly after, they noticed that there was kind of a light in the corner of the home, and it began to grow rather quickly. And at this point, they realized that the home was actually on fire. And at this point, they decided to force their way into the home, which is completely normal. Upon entry, they said that the entire living room was engulfed in flames, and they were yelling for anyone that might have remained in the residence to come out so that they could help them out of the home. And that is when 8-year-old Ronnie Jr. appears. They said he was covered in blood with severe and obvious abdominal injuries and very severe burns. He was immediately transported to the local hospital to get the medical attention that he very desperately needed. Shortly after Ronnie Jr. was taken away, his father, Ronnie O'Neill, came out and made himself known and was taken outside of the home, and he was immediately placed into custody. To avoid any confusion, 8-year-old Ronnie Jr., I'm going to just call him Ronnie Jr. the whole episode, and I will probably refer to the father, Ronnie O'Neill, as just O'Neill. But to continue, they were still missing the 9-year-old daughter of O'Neill and Kenyatta, and her name was Rhonavia. She was on the autism spectrum, and as a result of that was nonverbal, so she could not communicate verbally, and she was still missing. And upon law enforcement searching the home further, they did find Rhonavia with multiple stab wounds and burns, and she was pronounced dead at 12:30 a.m. Now, Ronnie Jr. had sustained numerous injuries, including multiple stab wounds to his neck, abdomen, chest, and extremities after his father had repeatedly stabbed him. After O'Neill stabbed Ronnie Jr., he poured gasoline over his body and set him on fire, resulting in 30% of his body being covered in burns. Now, thankfully, law enforcement had arrived on the scene just in time to get him the medical attention that he so desperately needed, and he was able to survive. And he went on to paint a picture for law enforcement of exactly what happened in his home that night. When the 911 call had come in that night from Kenyatta, she could be heard begging for her life while O'Neill was heard in the background screaming, and they could actually hear the noise of him beating her to death. And she had somehow managed to come outside which is where law enforcement would later find her body. But she had managed to make it outside, and so some neighbors had actually witnessed what had happened to her. And apparently O'Neill had shot her with a shotgun, was beating her with a shotgun, and eventually beat her to death. When Ronnie Jr. woke up, he said he had heard his dad screaming and saw his dad stab his older sister, Ronavia, with an axe. Her autopsy later listed her cause of death as homicidal violence, including chop, blade, and penetrating wounds. And Ronnie Jr. said his dad then moved on to stabbing him with a knife before using gasoline, tissue, and matches to set the home and Ronavia on fire. He also had poured gasoline on Ronnie Jr. and set him on fire as well. Now, interviews were conducted with neighbors, paternal relatives, and maternal relatives. Some neighbors had witnessed the death of Kenyatta, like I said, due to the fact that she'd fought her way outside to make an attempt at obviously running for her life. But the family denied any previous concerns or warning signs of any mental health issues, any domestic violence, any substance abuse or erratic behavior that might have helped piece together what the possible motive could have been for O'Neill slaying his entire family. On May 20th of 2018, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office arrested Ronnie O'Neill and charged him with two counts of first-degree murder with a weapon, first-degree arson, and resisting an officer without violence. Obviously, Ronnie Jr. had been removed from O'Neill's custody, but shortly after, a petition was filed to terminate any parental rights, and that petition was approved in December of 2018. Now, it's worth noting that Kenyatta did have an autopsy and that her cause of death was shotgun, it was homicidal violence, but it included blunt impact to the head and shotgun wounds to the torso and extremities. So, as the investigation continued, evidence started to unfold and came out that a possible motive for the killings could have been due to some tension that was happening between Kenyatta and O'Neill in O'Neill's efforts to convert the family to Islam. Ronnie Jr. told the police that before he had gone to bed that night on March 18th, his parents had been talking about God and religion and that they'd been arguing. According to Channel 8 News, witnesses told police in recorded statements that O'Neill strongly believed that women were of a lower stature than men. And while some witnesses had said there was no warning signs before the incident, others said that they had witnessed O'Neill threaten Kenyatta before. Neighbors said that O'Neill had been yelling from the roof of the home a few hours before everything had began that night. And shortly before Kenyatta had called 911, O'Neill had actually called 911 himself, ranting about a white demon being inside Kiki, which was Kenyatta's nickname, and that she had tried to kill him. And when 911 officers tried to ask, you know, where he was located, he hung up. And right after that was when Kenyatta placed a 911 call where, you know, she could be heard trying to plead with O'Neill, and they could hear him in the background screaming Allah Akbar, which means God is great. And I think that's also where some of that converting the family to Islam and the motive kind of comes in, because he was screaming that the night and while he was murdering her. Now, somewhere around October of 2018, doctors told the judge that Ronnie O'Neill was incompetent to stand trial, and he was transferred to a state hospital to receive treatment until he was mentally fit to be present for his defense. I think it's really obvious that some sort of mental illness is going on. You can watch videos of Ronnie too during the trial, which we'll get to in just a second. And he is just not does not seem normal, like whatsoever. Now, Ronnie O'Neill was finally declared mentally fit to stand trial, which began in June of this year, 2021. And he decided to represent himself instead of having an attorney represent him, which is never a good idea. During the opening statements, O'Neill screamed at the jurors, telling them that the entire case against him had been fabricated. He was saying, quote, "By the time this is all said and done, you will see who is the mass murderers in Tampa Bay," end quote. He claimed that the 911 call from Kenyatta was in fact fake, saying, quote, "Law enforcement tampered with evidence to meet their such high burden of proof," end quote. One neighbor testified saying that Kenyatta had actually managed to knock on their door that night, begging for help before she died, to which O'Neill said that he was lying and had fabricated his entire story. O'Neill went on to claim that Kenyatta had actually been the one that murdered their daughter, Rhonda Villa, and that he responded by killing Kenyatta when he found out what she had done and that she deserved it. This obviously was not the case, and his son, Ronnie Jr., who is now 11 years old, would tell the jurors exactly what did happen that night. And it was perhaps the most heartbreaking moment of the entire trial, watching O'Neill cross-examine his own son, who he had tried to murder just a few years before. When Ronnie Jr. took the stand, O'Neill asked him, quote, "Did I hurt you that night of this incident?" end quote. To which Ronnie Jr. replied, "Yes." O'Neill then asked, "I did? And how did I hurt you?" To which Ronnie Jr. replied, "You stabbed me." Ronnie Jr. went on to recount the night he watched his own father brutally murder his mother and sister right in front of him, saying, when asked about his sister, he said, quote, "He hit her with an axe in the back of the head, and then I saw her eyes roll, and there was blood everywhere," end quote. He then went on to explain that after his father was done murdering her, he then tried to kill him too. The last family member to testify in the trial was Ronnie O'Neill's father, Billy Smith, who testified that O'Neill had actually called him the night of the murders and told him the same thing that was heard on that 911 call before Kenyatta's, which was that Kiki had tried to murder him. And Smith said that he rushed to the family's home, but was too late. Now, this trial only lasted about 3 weeks, and the jury only deliberated for 3 hours before returning with a guilty verdict. And although the prosecution had sought out the death penalty in the case, the jury decided against it, saying that the aggravating circumstances in the case did not outweigh the mitigating circumstances. On July 23rd of this year, Ronnie O'Neill was sentenced to 3 life terms plus 60 years to be served consecutively. When asked how the victim's family felt about O'Neill not receiving the death sentence, Kenyatta's mother, Carrie Lloyd, said, quote, "He's going to be so miserable behind those bars, he's going to wish he was dead," end quote. Her sister agreed, saying, quote, "Either way, I still feel like it's a win," quote. Now, Detective Mike Blair was one of the responding officers that night of March 18th, 2018. He said that although he had responded to hundreds of calls throughout his career, this one changed his life forever. He said by the time he arrived on the scene that he was told that a child was being medevaced to Tampa General, but that the child was not expected to survive. And when Detective Blair went to visit the child, who was Ronnie Jr., at the hospital, he said that it changed everything for him. Throughout Ronnie Jr.'s recovery, Detective Blair would visit him regularly. He said he would bring him gifts from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the NFL football team, because he had some connections with them. And he said one night, as he was leaving, Ronnie grabbed his hand with just one simple request. He asked him if he could stay and watch a movie with him. Sorry, I'm gonna try really hard not to get emotional. Detective Blair said that he and his wife had had plans for a date night that night, but that he stepped out of the room and he called her to ask if she would mind coming to the hospital to watch a movie with Ronnie instead. And although Detective Blair and his wife had 5 children and a busy life, they ditched date night. And Danielle, who's Detective Blair's wife, said that she knew by the end of that night that she wanted to take Ronnie home with them. Now, at this point, Ronnie was still in the care of other relatives, but there were some problems in that home. So they told Ronnie's guardian, who was in charge of his case, to call them if he ever needed anything. And when that call came, Ronnie's guardian asked the couple if they knew anyone that could foster Ronnie, and the couple said immediately that they knew he belonged with their family. Today, Ronnie has been formally adopted by the Blair family and has 5 siblings who love him. When Ronnie spoke with Channel 8 News, he said that he didn't want his mom and sister to be remembered as murder victims, instead telling stories about how his mom played football with him even though she'd gone back to school and was very busy, how she pushed him on the swing, made him wings and the best bean pie. He talked about how he learned sign language so that he could communicate with his sister, and how even though she was severely handicapped, she still went to school and was recognized because of her positive attitude. He said, quote, "There's this thing called terrific kid, and she got that a lot," end quote. When speaking of his new family, Ronnie said, quote, "They are really nice people. They are the best moms and dads, and they really take care of me. There is no one better than them," end quote. His new parents said that they have a family mantra that Ronnie tells himself when he gets stressed out, and it goes, quote, "I am safe, I am loved, and I am part of this family," end quote. All right, and that is it for this week's episode. That was a rough one. Thank you for bearing with me through that last part. I think I retook that audio probably 8 or 9 times because I could not stop crying, but we got through it. A little shaky, but that's okay. I will be posting pictures of, I have one picture that I'm going to post on social media of Ronnie with his new family, and the last link in my show notes has several pictures of Ronnie with his new family if you guys want to go look at that and see that. I loved seeing those pictures. It was really special. Like I said last week, I'm staying up to date on all of the cases that I've been covering. I know big updates are coming for the Barry Morphew and Suzanne Morphew case, so stay tuned for those. As usual, you can find all of my sources for this episode in the show notes. You can find this podcast on Instagram at True Crime Cases Pod, on Twitter at TC Cases Pod, and on Facebook at True Crime Cases Podcast. Next Tuesday, I will be back with a brand new case. And until then, have a great rest of your week. Thank you so much.